From Entrepreneur Media, this is Problem Solvers, a show in which entrepreneurs do what entrepreneurs do best, solve unexpected problems in their business.
We were completely wrong.
And I'm just like, it's not selling.
It was like, we have to start from scratch.
I'm Jason Pfeiffer, the editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine.
I've been thinking a lot about where we are now. You know, we had the panic phase and then the adaptation phase and then the new normal phase. And now we're in something else. It's like the I finally realize there's no point in trying to go backwards phase, or it's the old problem solving mentality applied to new problems phase, or it's the we're in the future and we're still going phase, or it's the starting from what we know right now phase. I have to say, whatever it is, it's good. It's not easy, but it's good. And, you know, summer actually draws to a close this week. This episode is coming out on September 21st, and summer ends September 22nd, which is crazy. You know, at once, this time that we've all been living through since mid-March, it has gone by achingly slow. And then when you look back at it, incredibly fast, right? Like, there's so much happened all at once that we look back and we're like, oh my God, all these changes in our lives. And it didn't, all these changes in our business just happened in the last couple of months. Really, it wasn't years, it just happened in the last couple of months. So, as we draw down one season and open another, whatever that one's going to bring, I thought it was a good opportunity to use this episode of this podcast to just kind of think about some lessons learned about transitions and how to make change. And to do that, I'm going to draw from a monthly newsletter that I write called The Pfeiffer Five. If you are a fan of Problem Solvers, I think you will definitely love The Pfeiffer Five. It is this compilation that I put together each month of the five greatest insights into entrepreneurship that I had come across. Things that people had told me during interviews or observations that I had made about myself or about how people work. It's really meant to be inspirational and motivational and help you just step back and think. So, by the way, if you want to get it in your own inbox, please do. You can just go to my website. It is jasonpfeiffer.com. That is Jason, F as in Frank, EI, F as in Frank, ER.com. Go to jasonpfeiffer.com and you'll immediately get a little pop-up that prompts you to sign up. So you can check it out. This is kind of me bringing some of the greatest stuff from the last two issues of the Pfeiffer Five to life. And it's all about really making sure that we're thinking about how to think about what's next, right? We can't just go blindly smash facing into what's next. Let's think about it. Let's prepare for it. Let's embrace it. So, all coming up after the break.
For business owners, saving time is everything, because each minute saved can be put back into growing your business. So when you need a business loan, U.S. Bank makes the process quick and convenient. Meet with a banker or apply from anywhere with a simple and secure online application and get a decision in minutes. Save time with U.S. Bank so you can get back to what you do best, running your business. Apply today at usbank.com/fundmybusiness. Credit products offered by U.S. Bank National Association, Equal Housing Lender.
All right, we're back. So, like I said, we are talking today about transitions and how to really think about what comes next and how to feel prepared for it. And the thing that I am going to first tell you about, and you are not going to see this coming, it is Weird Little Forks from the 1800s. Yes, Weird Little Forks from the 1800s. What does that possibly have to do with now and, for that matter, tomorrow? Aha! Well, let me tell you. If you attended a dinner party in the mid-1800s, you might have eaten each food with a different fork. There were forks designed to eat sardines with. There were lettuce forks, pickle forks, cherry forks. For dessert, you'd have had a pastry fork. And, oh yeah, then there's the macaroni fork.
My very favorite fork is the mid-19th century macaroni fork.
That's Dara Goldstein. She's a food historian and cookbook writer and author most recently of a book called Beyond the North Wind. And she spoke to me for my other podcast, Pessimist's Archive, which is where I'm drawing this from. So, okay, the macaroni fork?
that looks like an instrument of torture because it has these really, really sharp blades, but it has a bit of a bowl so that you cut the macaroni and then can scoop it without compressing it. Macaroni was very chic in the mid-19th century.
Maybe you've seen some of these forks if you ever, I don't know, like dug through your grandma's old collection of silverware. Anyway, why do these things exist? Why was there a macaroni fork? In truth, it had nothing to do with food and everything to do with business. These forks are a lesson in entrepreneurship. They're an insight into how smart companies can adapt to changing times by understanding exactly what their customer wants. The silverware companies of the 1800s, they knew that. And oftentimes, they knew that their customer's top priority wasn't the product. It was how the product makes them feel. So to understand what was happening with forks, let me give you just like a quick, really interesting background about where the fork came from. So the fork, you know, it's common today, but it's a relatively new addition to our table. For most of the past two millenniums, the attitude towards the fork basically went like this.
God has given us our hands. God gives us food. Our hands are worthy of touching that food. And you introduce something that is foreign and alien and metal that distances from the God-given food, and that is bad.
Forks did gain some popularity in Byzantium, which then became Constantinople, in the 11th century when upper-class women used them to eat candied fruit. But when a Byzantium princess married a Venetian leader, she brought a fork with her, and things did not go well.
The world of Venice was aghast.
And that's in part because the tool was immediately associated with the devil, because the forks of those days had two prongs, which looked like satanic horns.
Unfortunately for the poor princess, she fell very ill and died shortly. So that was proof that she was consorting with the devil. And then the fork pretty much disappeared for a few more centuries.
The fork made a comeback during the Renaissance, beginning in the 1400s. Wealthy people in Florence, Italy, began constructing dining rooms for the first time and then hosting elaborate banquets in them. They would serve up to 100 courses, have live birds flying out of pies, and wanted to create a sense of elegance and sophistication. The fork served that purpose. They enabled all these people to eat without messing up their hands. After that, forks slowly gained acceptance around Europe. But when America declared its independence from Great Britain a few centuries later, its new citizens decided that the fork was not for them. When John Quincy Adams became president in 1825, he used forks in the White House, and Dara says Americans were aghast. They said,
"It's just not the way we as Americans who are simple people who have fled all of the class system of Europe, and you're introducing something that distinguishes yourself from the rest of us."
So what changed? That is how this becomes a story of entrepreneurship. Up until the 1800s, utensils were extremely expensive. I mean, ancient Romans made them out of lead, but that was a health hazard. Later, people made them out of steel, but that can rust and make food taste bad. There just weren't a lot of good options for safe, durable material throughout the centuries, except for very expensive metals. Silver was good. Gold was better. For this reason, the average person might splurge to buy a single spoon and knife, but a fork was deemed an unnecessary luxury item. It became instead a status symbol for the rich. And then the market changed. Silver plating was commercialized in the 1840s, which created a market of affordable silver-plated forks. Then, in 1859, a massive amount of silver known as the Comstock Lode was discovered in Nevada, which flooded the market and lowered the price of silver. Suddenly, the average person could buy a fork, which meant the wealthy had lost their status symbol. Now, a fork was no longer cool, it was common, and that was a problem for silver companies.
So what were the wealthy to do? They still had to find a way to be distinctive?
The dominant silver companies of the day, like Tiffany and Gorham, understood this. They knew that, to their wealthy customers, a fork was not just a tool for eating. It was a symbol, and using it made them feel special. To maintain their fork business, they needed to find new ways to deliver that same emotional value. They
started making all different kinds of forks for each different kind of food.
Testing, 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 testing. This is where sardine, olive, and macaroni forks come from. These new products came with new routines. A customer could feel exclusive by using a specialized fork for each item on a plate, while the rest of the world just used the same old fork for everything. Did it last? Well, yes and no. Most of these forks eventually faded away, being replaced by even newer products that inspired those same old emotions, but a few are still with us, like the salad fork and the fish fork. But most importantly, these forks remain a quirky lesson in customer obsession. A brand produces products and services, but entrepreneurs can't be defined solely by what they create. They have to understand the deeper connection they create with their consumer, the way they fit into people's lives, and the emotional value they deliver. If an entrepreneur can internalize that, they'll have a far easier time pivoting during times of change. Because while tastes may evolve and industries and markets will shift, consumers will always, always want to feel special. If you want to know more about the history of the fork, oh boy, do I have more about the history of the fork. Just go to that podcast that I told you, Pessimists Archive, and find the episode. It's the newest episode right now. It's called Why We Eat with a Fork. It's Not the Food. And again, this comes from this kind of little write-up, this focus in on the entrepreneurial insight comes from my newsletter, The Pfeiffer Five. And right here, right now, what I have for you is two more insights about how to think about the future coming from that newsletter. So here's one. This is based off of something that somebody had emailed me recently. I get emails like this all the time, and it always makes me think, you're doing it wrong. You're reaching out wrong, not just to me, to everybody. And so this time I decided to write back to this person, and then I shared what I wrote. So here's what the person emailed me. They emailed me this, quote, "I wanted to know if you have any freelance work. I don't have experience, but I have raw and transferable talent that I am eager to show you if you would give me the opportunity to," end quote. And okay, the response that I sent him, which I'm going to read in a second, is very focused on this request about freelance work, but it is so broadly applicable because it's really, really a response to those words that he said at the end there, which was, "if you would give me the opportunity to." So here's what I said. I said I didn't have freelance work to give him, but then I wrote, quote, "When you reach out to publications, don't ask if there's freelance work. The answer will almost always be no. Instead, reach out and convince someone with your ideas and your words that you are right for them. Write something that you think will be a fit for that publication and submit it, or send a bunch of very thoughtful, compelling ideas. When I was a rookie reporter, I pitched a fully formed idea to the Washington Post. The editor was interested, but not willing to commit because I was so young and inexperienced. So I interviewed 10 people and sent her a 3,000-word outline. That convinced her. It's how I got my start writing for national publications. And this is what you need to do. Deliver something that people cannot turn down. If you ask for an opportunity, the answer will be no. But if you come showing that you are an opportunity, the answer could be yes," end quote. So that's what I wrote, and it's the advice I now offer to you too. Now it's up to him and to all of us to be the opportunity, not to ask for it, to be it. All right, and here is one final insight from that newsletter, and it starts with this question. Do you know why people like you? I'm realizing something. In at least one case, I did not. So as you know, and in fact, as you just heard, I host this podcast called Pessimists Archive. I've often described it as a history show about why people resist new things, because it explores why people were afraid of innovations that today we think of as commonplace, like teddy bears and mirrors in the elevator. And I thought people liked it because they were interested in technology or history or innovation, because that's what the show focuses on. But recently, I brought a consultancy called Pen Name on to help grow the show. And one of the first things that they did was survey and start interviewing members of my audience. The results came back and they were blowing my mind. A giant revelation, for example, people listen to the show not because they're curious about the specific subject matter, but because the show makes them feel more resilient to the future. This small insight rocked me. I mean, like, I now feel like I understand the point of my show and the needs of my audience and the direction of everything else I create. Now, Pen Name is run by my friends Adam and Jordan Bornstein, and they also write an excellent business newsletter for Pen Name. It's called Monday Reflections, and a recent edition contained this insight that reminded me a lot of the revelation that I just had about my show. So I want to read it to you. Here's what they wrote. You know what sucks? Not really knowing if your buyers love what you have to offer. This isn't about if they purchased or used your product or service. The question is, did they love it? No business should ever be blind to the opinions of their customers. Lots of people do market research, but we've found that not enough people survey their actual users. Once you have customers, you should be in constant contact with them. They are more important to your business than anything else you'll do. Oftentimes, your customers will give you the ability to see the barriers between your business and growth. Communicating with them will help you understand if you're doing your job well and what you can be doing to become better tomorrow. And that's the end of the quote. Now, I can testify to this so much. It's not enough to just know that someone likes you. You should know why they like you. You should know the need that you fulfill for them. That's the only way to truly solidify your value. So, what did we learn in this episode of Problem Solvers? I'm going to go back. There are three things here. One, that story of the forks is really all about managing change and seeing how when something disappears, you still have a great opportunity so long as you understand what it is that your customers need. And then we talked about how to find new opportunity that don't just look around. You know, as we change times or we try to get into something new, people look around and they're just like, if somebody would just give me the opportunity. No. Be the opportunity. Go out there and show that you are the opportunity. Present the value first, and then people will come to you. And then number three, which is actually kind of similar to number one, but it goes in a somewhat different direction, is people may buy from you, they may use your service, but if you don't understand why they love you, exactly what need you are fulfilling to them, then you are blind and you are not able to figure out what to do next. But if you're really in contact with them, if you understand the way that you fit into their lives, then wow, the possibilities are endless. So again, all of that comes from my newsletter. It's called The Pfeiffer Five. I would love if you subscribe so we can stay in touch even more regularly than this. And the way to do that is to go to my website. It is jasonpfeiffer.com, J-A-S-O-N, F as in Frank, E-I, F as in Frank, E-R.com, and you'll be prompted to sign up. Anyway, whether I speak to you through this podcast or write to you through the newsletter, talk to you soon and enjoy the first days of fall. And that's our episode. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to Problem Solvers wherever you get your podcasts. We come out with a new episode every Monday morning and you don't want to miss it. And hey, be kind. Pass the show along to an entrepreneur friend who could use a boost. And did you solve a problem that would be good for this show? Let me know about it. Visit my website, jasonpfeiffer.com, J-A-S-O-N-F-E-I-F-E-R.com, where you can find my contact information and all sorts of other valuable info. Problem Solvers is a production of Entrepreneur Media. Be sure to visit entrepreneur.com for all your entrepreneurship needs. And even better, subscribe to our magazine, which is just full of the smartest entrepreneurs solving the toughest problems. My name is Jason Pfeiffer, the editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine. Thanks for listening. And hey, let's go solve some problems.